Hello and welcome to the Full of Beans podcast, hosted by myself, Hannah Hickenbotham. Throughout these podcast episodes, we will speak to a range of individuals about their experience of eating disorders, with the aim of increasing awareness and understanding whilst reducing stigma and isolation. Please note that the topics discussed in this podcast may be triggering for some individuals, so tread lightly, check in with yourself, and reflect on these conversations. In this week's episode, I'm joined by Kate Moore-Youssef. Kate is the host of the award-winning podcast, the ADHD Women's Wellbeing Podcast, author of the ADHD Women's Wellbeing Toolkit, ADHD Lifestyle and Wellbeing Coach, EFT practitioner, mum of four, and late in life diagnosed with ADHD herself. We discuss all about Kate's new book, the ADHD Women's Wellbeing Toolkit, in this episode, and also talk about what Kate has learned about the link between ADHD and disordered eating as a result of speaking to so many experts about the topic on her podcast. It was an absolute pleasure to have Kate on the podcast, and I really hope you enjoy listening. Well, Kate, it is so lovely to have you on the podcast. How are you doing?
I'm good. Thank you, Hannah. It's lovely to be here.
Yeah, it's so exciting to have you. I'm such a big fan of your podcast, so to have you on Full of Beans feels like a very nice moment.
Oh, well, I'm delighted to be here and, yeah, looking forward to this conversation.
Absolutely. And did you want to just introduce yourself to the listeners?
Yeah, so I'm Kate Moore-Youssef. I'm the host of the ADHD Women's Wellbeing podcast. I'm also the author of a brand new book that's just about to come out called the ADHD Women's Wellbeing Toolkit. And I've built over the years a community of women who have sort of discovered their neurodivergence later on in life. So I've got a coaching platform and community and do lots of different workshops. And yeah, I was also, you know, diagnosed at the age of 40 back in 2020 with ADHD alongside my daughter. So yes, we've definitely created a bit of a movement over the past few years and thankfully helped build a lot more awareness and understanding around ADHD in women and girls.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's amazing to hear the community that you've built. I think often with this sort of thing, it can feel very isolating. So to know that there's other people going through similar things and to be able to lean into their experiences is so helpful. What was it that led you to get a diagnosis when you were 40?
So I'd always known about ADHD because I had two brothers who were diagnosed as children with ADHD. So they were diagnosed really early doors in my older brother probably late 80s, my younger brother early 90s. And that was very early on where people were just talking about ADD. And it was just difficulty you know, concentrating at school or being disruptive or just not being able to sit down in class. It was all very sort of surface level back then. And really actually only up until recently. And then the pandemic came, I was homeschooling my four kids, and my daughter, who was 9 at the time, who's now 14, she had always had difficulty at school with different sort of academic things, and whether it's processing or sitting on a chair or concentrating or handwriting, speech development, there was always something going on, but no one ever could explain to me what it was. You know, I took lots of different testings and it never came back conclusive. So she was, to me, was just this, my gorgeous little girl who was happy and chatty and daydreamy and twirly and all the things. Very similar to me as a child, but it was when I was homeschooling her, I knew that there was something, a massive block for her to be able to just get into the headspace to learn. Mm-hmm. And then there was a lot of overwhelm and a lot of just so much kind of anxiety. And she was 9 and I was thinking, this is not right. So it was early doors actually for the pandemic. And I just spoke to an online, you know, psychologist, and they were like, oh yeah, let's try and do an ADHD assessment. And then we did that, and it was just wow, like everything they asked, it was just me as a kid. But I'd seen the way it showed up over time for me as well. So it wasn't just what I saw as a kid, it was, you know, later on in my teens, you know, as a young adult, postnatally, throughout all my hormonal, you know, years. And that's when I was like, I have to go and get assessed as well. So we got actually diagnosed within only a few weeks of each other. Yeah. And we kind of went on this learning experience together. We learned and grew, and I studied and I researched, and I just went down a massive rabbit hole of trying to understand something that I'd been living with for so long, and essentially who I was already helping as a coach, because I was already coaching and working with women. And I always used to just describe them as like kind of like my tribe, but I didn't really have a blanket kind of terminology, because these were the women who were also feeling the same as me: overwhelmed, anxious, stressed, probably overthinkers, ambitious, curious, creative. It was just all these little different things with so many different traits and variabilities of how it showed up. And that for me was a massive thing, because it was like, right, okay, not only am I ADHD, I think so many of the people that I'm working with are as well. Mm-hmm. And that's when I started specifically going and doing more training and learning about ADHD. And that's when I just thought, right, that's it. I'm gonna train as an ADHD coach and become, I guess, start working that capacity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's amazing. I think it's so beautiful that you and your daughter did that together. I mean, my mum hasn't been diagnosed, and I know she won't mind me saying this, but so many of the traits that I recognize, I also recognize in her. And I think we were actually having this conversation the other day, and it's exactly what you were just saying, because I was saying to my mum that I was kind of struggling with something, and I said to her, I just turned to her and I was like, it's really hard for you to understand, isn't it? Because I'm just me to you. Like, to the doctor or to somebody that, you know, gets or works in ADHD, you see the traits, and mm-hmm. then you can kind of support someone with that. But I said to him, I was like, I'm just Hannah to you. And like, you know, there's the difficulties and the strengths and things like that. But you know, me being forgetful and messy and everything like that is just, it's just Hannah to my mum.
Yeah.
So I think for me, that was quite a difficult thing in explaining that I had ADHD to my friends or to family mm-hmm. members, because one, the traits in women don't tend to necessarily be what we expect, because we've massively focused on, you know, ADHD in men, which mm-hmm. kind of, you know, your point about your brothers being diagnosed so much younger really highlights that. But equally, to my friends, they're just my quirks, mm-hmm. and they are still just my quirks. And sometimes I find that quite difficult to balance in, you know, is it just Hannah's quirks or is it ADHD and how to label that?
Yeah, I totally get that for sure. And I have that as well. And my kids actually, so over the years now, we've realized they're all neurodivergent in different ways, and we've had them, you know, diagnosed. It's been really helpful from a academic perspective, I guess, for where they have been, but also to help them understand themselves in different things. And we always have this kind of conversation, because my kids always say to me, oh, you make everything about ADHD, because I see the nuances of it mm-hmm. and I see where it shows up. And yes, it might be a quirk or a character trait, but there's always a deeper rooted reasoning behind it. Mm. There's always a reasoning, and my kids don't see that yet. They just see me constantly going, that's your ADHD. But I kind of want it to be like an awareness. I want them to have that awareness. So because I correlated so much of the things that I struggled with like a personality problem or a flaw. Mm-hmm. And I want it to be separate. And I want them to know what they can get help with, or where they can be responsible for, where they do feel empowered. And where, yes, that is a real challenge, and feel validated that that is why they're struggling. And it's not because they're lazy or they're silly or they're not trying. And, you know, we hear this language being bandied around. And so I think it's really important that the awareness is there. And that's why I'm such a big advocate for screening, you know, from a young age, so we can see that difference. Yeah, everyone is unique. Every personality is different. ADHD shows up so differently. And I always say that, like, you'll never have one person who's the same with ADHD, because of the spectrum and how the co-occurring traits are, and, you know, whether there's autism there as well, and how that fluctuates, the different volumes of the spectrums at different times in your life, according to stressors and responsibilities. So it's ever changing. It's constantly, it's an ecosystem that I always see is just changing, like the weather, and we have to kind of just accept it a little bit, but understand it as well, so we can work with it and we can get help and we can get support and speak to the people who are closest to us. I think what you were saying before is that girls, especially in women, we've just been conditioned to mask. So we have masked and we've learned how to mask. So maybe that Hannah, so it's so lovely that you can have those quirks with your friends, but a lot of people hide those quirks and hide that true, and then they go home and they can completely unmask, and you know, but that's hard work, you know, if you're spending kind of 85% of your life masking to show a version of you that you think is socially acceptable.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, I have done a lot of work over the past couple of years, well, the past year, sorry, since my diagnosis, in terms of actually evaluating friendships and thinking about which friendships do I feel like I can be authentically me, and which friendships am I really having to be something that I'm not. And it's not that there's anything wrong necessarily with those people, but it's just we don't kind of fit together in the same way. Whereas, you know, it's so funny because the people that I am so close to now, I always say to them, it's like there's a wire between our brains and you just get each other.
Yeah.
But equally within that, as you said, whilst my friends, we do have very similar characteristics and similar traits, there's still such diversity within that. Like, I was really stressed the other day, and something I find really calming is walking through Tesco, the aisles, when there's hardly anyone in there, and just browsing the aisles. I don't know why I enjoy it, but I like subconsciously always take myself to Tesco's when I'm stressed. Wow. And then the other day I realized, oh my God, like I do this and it actually calms me down. And I text my friend and she was like, that's literally my worst nightmare. Yeah, like the lighting, the noise, the people. And so I was like, that's so funny to see how we are all so different. But equally, I think from day to day, I can be so different. You know, sometimes I'm super high energy and want to be outside and, you know, seeing my friends and absolutely buzzing on life. And then other days are just what I call potato. I just want to sit on the sofa under a blanket and that be it. But I think it's having that compassion for recognizing that's okay, that things are ever changing. You know, if one day you feel a certain way, that's okay. But it's about being compassionate and understanding to yourself.
Yeah, 100%. And that is, and we learn that as we go along, because if we don't have the knowledge, we don't have the understanding, and we'll always be berating ourselves and criticizing ourselves and pushing ourselves to be better or do more or change. And that is why so many, you know, especially women who are finding out much later in life, they're so exhausted and burnt out, and they've had so many difficult mental health challenges because they've not had this understanding, because that compassion hasn't been there. The compassion has been completely lacking, and the only thing that they can hear is the voice of self-criticism. And if that is the leading voice in your life, that's a really difficult life to live. Like, you're trying to fit into a life that's not yours. And like you say, with just even with friendships, just to know, okay, so that's why I get on better with those type of people, or that's why I enjoy doing this activity over something else, or I don't enjoy this. And we just, I always say it's like a key. We just get a key finally to the life that we've never quite understood, like we've known is different, and that's it. And then we just can make choices. We can make choices that feel more aligned to us, and we can say yes to things that light us up and no to things that deplete us. And it not be like judgment, you know, full of judgment. We can just do it totally judgment-free and go, well, that's because if I go there to that place with those people, I feel really anxious and I really don't enjoy it. And I feel like I'm always having to try to be someone else. And we get that understanding. And I think that for me is priceless. I really do. And I think to bring that earlier to the earlier, younger generations, so they don't have to go half a lifetime of trying to mold themselves into something, a career, a relationship, family, whatever that is. Just to have more freedom to make choices that work for them, I think is so powerful.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, that kind of, it's almost that self-trust piece of, for, I felt like when I got diagnosed, it kind of, as you said, it unlocked something. And then over time, the more I lent into thinking about what I wanted to do, or thinking, actually, that situation right now is really going to deplete me, the more I then started to trust that I knew what was right for me in that moment. And I think that can be such a big piece in terms of, you know, helping you move forward with it. And something that I wanted to ask you about, and I know that, you know, you're not an expert in terms of disordered eating, but obviously you've spoken to so many people on your podcast about ADHD and disordered eating, and I think it's often something that people struggle with. And I wondered what maybe some common themes you've heard from the podcast about disordered eating related to ADHD were.
Yeah, so You know, very early on when I started working in this space, I had a client who had suffered with binge eating disorder for a very, very long time. And she just couldn't understand. She couldn't understand it. Mm. And that diagnosis for her was a really big explanation. It was this psychoeducation about what's going on in her brain with dopamine, with serotonin, with all the different ways that her brain was working, self-soothing, all of that, the emotional dysregulation. So for her to have that understanding of, okay, so this hasn't been my fault. It's not something that I need to blame myself for. There's a neurological or a neurobiological reasoning that my brain works differently. And this is why I've been prone to being like this for so long. And it shows up in so many different ways. And obviously, you know, you're the expert here, but I've seen it in binge eating. I've seen it in sugar addiction, in anorexia. I have seen it as well. I've seen it show up in different ways, but even very more of a nuanced way where it's just a constant hum, like a low level hum that's there. And it's that voice of sort of self-criticism of you should be doing that or you shouldn't be doing that. And I do think there are perfectionist tendencies that probably go along with that, because we know that perfectionism does go in hand with ADHD in women. There's lots of different theories around it, but it's around trying to fit in, trying to be more socially acceptable, people pleasing, perhaps past social trauma as well, of just not quite feeling like we belong. And so I think it's so multi-layered. I think there's definitely a brain sort of neurobiological reason, but I also think there's a lot of trauma or stuck emotions, a combination of it all. I think it's very much not quite understanding ourselves, not having explanations for our behavior and our brains. So it really does show up in lots of different ways. But what I would love to see more of, and I've spoken to a few sort of people in the disordered eating kind of arena, doctors, psychologists, psychiatrists, around if someone comes in and it's flagged up straight away, can there be a very early screening, you know, from the minute they walk into the GP of what are the traits, what are the neurodivergent traits potentially are going on here? Mm-hmm. Because for me, I think, and I don't know the stats and I don't know the percentage, but I think there's a really high percentage of neurodivergence going on in long-term eating disorders. And I would love to see really early screening so we can help more people so it doesn't have to spiral so dreadfully. And we hear terrible stories, and that is why it should be just, okay, let's ask some questions about social stuff. Let's ask what's going on at school, what's going on from maybe other addictions or RSD, you know, talking about, do you know about rejection sensitive dysphoria? Do you know how that might show up for you? Let's talk about hormones. Let's find out what's going on for you. You know, maybe from puberty onwards, what happens? Do you suffer with, you know, PMDD? We know that a lot of this is interconnected. So if someone has PMDD and you're dealing with that for 2 weeks of your cycle, that's going to have a massive impact on you from every direction of your life. So we need GPs knowing this already. We need that. I don't know if that's something that you've come across, but for me, it's always about the early screening and having more awareness from the minute someone walks in through that door, and they can ask better positioned questions as opposed to more surface level stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, from my perspective and kind of working within research, I think there's a general understanding of the link between things like bulimia nervosa and binge eating disorder and ADHD because of things like you said, those dopamine seeking behaviors, the kind of impulsivity that can be associated with eating and maybe that uncontrollable eating. But I think, I mean, and there's definitely not enough research there. So we absolutely need to be doing more of that. And like you say, that screening element, I think if someone's coming in and we're recognizing those traits, it may be, it probably will be, that their treatment might need to be adjusted a little bit in order to meet them, you know, with their neurodiversity and what could be most helpful for them. I mean, I do think that all eating disorder treatment in general, it does need to be more individualised, because it is very blanket mm-hmm. in terms of these are the symptoms you have and this is the treatment we'll give you. And actually, you know, as you've kind of explained there, in that, you know, the eating comes from something kind of deeper. Mm-hmm. And often the eating behaviours are a way of expressing what's going on further down. So it might be, yes, that you're struggling with binge eating, but what's actually underneath that? You know, is it trauma? Is it self-esteem? That sort of thing, to explore that. But I think another area of research that we really need to do, and it's something I'm hearing more and more, is actually, I guess, quite similar to my own experience, in that I now realise, having been diagnosed with ADHD, that anorexia was very much a way to just suppress mm-hmm. everything that was kind of going on. You know, all the chaos, all the emotional dysregulation. By starving myself, I didn't feel any of that. And I think that was, it felt like the perfect way. I didn't realise I had ADHD at the time, but it felt like the perfect way to just numb and suppress from everything. And similarly, another thing that I hadn't even thought of that you just mentioned there, if you're starving yourself, you often lose your period, which mm-hmm. then means you don't have things like PMDD. So if those are all of those symptoms that you're struggling with, it might feel like anorexia is the way out of that in order to kind of get rid of all those emotions. And so then if somebody's presenting in a clinic with anorexia, we need to, as you said, to have that screening to be able to understand if neurodiversity is playing a role there, and, you know, what the role of the eating disorder is within that. And it's interesting as well that you mention kind of the more long-standing eating disorders. I've been doing some work recently with the Royal College of Psychiatry, looking at putting together a position statement for long-standing and severe eating disorders. And something that's come up quite a lot is undiagnosed neurodiversity, which has then been the thing that's almost prolonged somebody struggling yeah. with an eating disorder. Because, you know, I'm not saying that you need to know the root cause, because I think we could spend hours in a therapy room trying to understand what the root cause is and not getting there. But having an understanding of the role that neurodiversity is playing, and then the role that the eating disorder is playing to kind of support that, I think it could be absolutely life-changing for someone's treatment. And I think that because it was for mine.
Yeah, absolutely. And I really do believe that, you know, when you were talking about the suppression, mm-hmm. I was talking about this to a client the other day, and she's actually only young, she's 19, and was helping her understand where depression comes from and where anxiety comes from. And for her to, she would always say to me, it's just easier to suppress and to repress. And I said, well, where do you think the word depression comes from? It's probably mm-hmm. repressed emotions. And that is where it comes from. But then if we've got anxiety, that's like fear and worry, you know, for the future. So for her to be able to almost understand her emotions of where that was coming from, and why, when, you know, why she was feeling anxious, okay, because she was worrying about her exams or handing a dissertation in. And then when she was feeling low, depressed, it's because she didn't want to access her emotions. She didn't want to talk about her childhood. She didn't want to go there with regards to maybe some school stuff. It's much easier to hold it in, push it down. So many of us do this, but without any awareness whatsoever. And if you are walking around undiagnosed, neurodiverse, and you have lived like that for years, but there has been a huge amount of trauma, you know, I go back to like the social stuff for girls. There might have been bullying. There might have been exclusion from friendship groups. Again, RSD, not fitting in. That travels with you and that stays with you. Unless you've been really, really fortunate to have a lovely group of friends and just had a great upbringing and lots of different things. There's always still something, you know, but girls especially, because we are conditioned to all be this sort of subservient, kind, helpful, all of these things that girls are sort of told to be, that that's a good way of being a girl, being a good friend, a good daughter, a good wife, all of that. And our needs are pushed right down, we're pushed right down. And so it can show up in so many different ways. And eating disorders is one of them. Addiction is another one. Depression, anxiety, gut issues, really difficult sort of hormonal and fluctuations, inflammation, pain, you know, chronic fatigue. It goes all over, and it has to come out one way. That's what I always say. And it just depends on you. I guess it depends on your genetics, your makeup. It's very much epigenetic, this neurodivergent situation. And I do believe it's like a balloon, I guess, that's being filled and filled and filled. Eventually, a a whole and it's going to come out and then whatever way that comes out. So we have to address the neurodivergence, that undiagnosed, that's lived with us from the very beginning, and then we can start layer by layer, you know, healing. And that can be through must be through neuroaffirming coaching or therapy. Mm-hmm. You can't go and heal with someone that doesn't understand ADHD or autism. You just can't. And that is why it's so important that we start really from the foundations. And I wonder why so many doctors aren't seeing it like that. And I think that with the growth in awareness, we are. But I do feel from speaking to a few doctors in this industry, it's still quite surface level. They're not getting to the root as quickly as they should be. Mm. And then we hear about stories like yours where it's gone on and on and on. And actually the neurodivergence should have been the first thing that they picked out. And that's what I would really love to see more of.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt. I wonder if it's just we are both obviously very interested in the topic. And I wonder if for doctors, whilst it is something that they should absolutely have awareness of and understanding, is it that, you know, there's so much going on that they then kind of, you know, don't have the time or the resources to understand it as much as we would hope. Not giving excuses or anything, but I do think, you know, we know that the NHS is so stretched. But as a society, I do think we're becoming very much more aware of neurodiversity. So I think that, you know, that information should be almost at the forefront of a doctor's mind when they're supporting someone with anything, really. Because I do think that, as you've said, you know, neurodiversity, particularly, I think, you know, and I'm not saying that to be a neurodivergent man is an easy ride, but I think the recognition is there more so. And it's interesting because I went to a talk, it's slightly different, but I went to a talk about autism in women, and the lady presenting was saying how, you know, it's quite an interesting way to think, but because as women we are told, you know, suppress yourself, be quiet, sit in the corner, look pretty, we from an early age learn to mask, whereas because boys aren't told that, they're just kind of out there with whoever they are. And so, you know, if you are thinking about stereotypes, the stereotypical autistic man, you know, you can probably think of that in your head. And not every autistic man is going to present like a stereotypical autistic man. But I think that we can much easily kind of in our head think about the stereotype as opposed to maybe what an autistic woman seems like. And one thing I was thinking about when you were talking about that in terms of, you know, the pressure to be a woman and kind of sit in the corner and what have you, I was thinking a bit about also that like RSD element in terms of the impact that that would have on someone's body image and self-esteem. Mm. And I know in my experience, realizing that going to the gym and exercising made me lose weight and develop a body type that, you know, was glorified within society, I finally felt like I fit in. You know, I'd gone from being in school where every single group I put myself in, I never quite found my people. And then all of a sudden I was in the gym and I started getting comments from people that I didn't really even know. I'd just be walking down the street and they'd be like, "You look great." And it was that validation I'd been seeking so much from friends and society and finally got it, which I think, you know, can be very damaging, particularly when you're already someone that's vulnerable to things like disordered eating.
Yeah. It's a hard one because from a maybe more of a spiritual perspective, I know that as we get older, we become wiser, we can understand life, we're able to, you know, that version of you, Hannah, you know, 10 years ago is not the version of you right now. Mm. And we know different things. And I know different things, even looking back 2 years ago, sometimes I listen to the podcast, you know, and I was thinking, oh my God, like she doesn't know anything yet. And we have to recognize that is the world, you know, with regards to from 5 years ago when I started working in this space to how it is now, we are talking so much more about neurodiversity. Mm-hmm. You know, the amount of articles and TV programs and friends of mine who kids are getting diagnosed, like it's out there so much more. Like it's not going back in the bag, but we still have a long way to go. But it's okay to be reflective. And I think it's okay to know that we are all understanding this. We're all gaining, you know, insights. So many people, you know, when they get the diagnosis and they say, if only I'd known, and there's so much grief around losing so many years of their life. And I totally get that. But we weren't there. The world wasn't there then. You know, maybe in 10 years' time, we're going to look and kind of think, what, I can't believe what we didn't know. And I'm sure we will. I'm sure we will look back and think, I can't believe there was so much we didn't know. And so I do give the doctors the benefit of doubt. Yeah. But what I do get upset about is that from maybe like a school perspective, teacher training hasn't really been updated, you know, a huge amount. And so we know that special education needs are still a tiny bit of teacher training. And also being, you know, training to be a doctor, my niece is training to be a doctor. And I know full well that neurodiversity is a tiny, tiny, tiny bit of their doctor training. I spoke to a newly qualified doctor a few months ago. She's probably early mid-20s. And I was telling her what I did. And she genuinely knew nothing. And she is an A&E doctor. And she was, well, tell me how it shows up in women. Like, what would, you know, what would it look like? And what signs? And I said, well, if you've got a patient that is coming in and they've got X, Y, and Z and da, 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 and they're presenting like this. And I kind of gave her lots of different scenarios. You might want to ask if they are either they've been screened for neurodiversity or have they got a diagnosis, all of this. And especially around women's health as well. Like if someone's coming in with endometriosis or, you know, gut issues, pain, all different things, it's so important to have this in the top of your mind that I could be dealing with a neurodivergent patient here and there could be other issues going on. Mm-hmm. And that should be something that doctors should be taught in every part. Like now I'm understanding through the podcast that cardiac issues are greater. There's a greater percentage for women with ADHD. We know that we go through early perimenopause. We know that we're more prone to depression, anxiety. We're more prone to migraines, chronic fatigue, fibromyalgia, hypermobility. These are physical, you know, medical conditions. Mm-hmm. And we should be seeing neurodivergent training and teaching going into all avenues of medical healthcare. And that is why it's so important, because you can't go in as a neurodivergent patient and speak to your doctor and there's a very high chance it's going to be connected in some way. Interestingly, I've got a doctor client and we were talking yesterday and she said something about her hay fever. And I said, did you know that a lot of neurodivergent people have histamine intolerance? She said, no. I said, there's a very high connection to histamine intolerance or mast cell activation disorder and ADHD. And she had no idea. So there's lots of correlation between that. So people have sort of have more, there's more chance of asthma, hay fever, skin conditions, eczema, that type of kind of profile. It's an inflammatory profile. And that's just sort of part of this genetic makeup that we don't understand yet. Like we don't have this understanding. A great book actually by Dr. James Custo, who has written How to Thrive with Adults ADHD. I probably promoted his book way more than I promoted my own book. But it's a really, really good book because he's a doctor. And he is at the forefront of connecting all the dots, this constellation of symptoms and traits that we find ourselves in that is physical and mental and spiritual and all sorts that we find ourselves in. So it's not just our ADHD. It never is just our ADHD.
And I think that's the thing, isn't it? It's with neurodiversity, whether it's ADHD, autism, whatever, it does touch everything. And I think that's something I've really had to work through myself in thinking, you know, not just when we think about medical conditions, but I've really kind of worked through the label of it, because I never wanted to refer to myself as anorexic because I was not anorexia. Anorexia was something that I had and that I was going to recover from. But I think I also struggle with the element of ADHD, because I know that some people will say that they are ADHD, some people will say that they have ADHD. And personally, I think, you know, that's for you to decide as to how you want to say that. But it's almost like what, you know, we were talking about before in terms of it does impact everything, and you have your strengths and you have your challenges, and it's about acknowledging them with compassion and working through that. But sometimes I try not to get caught up in the fact that I have ADHD because, as we were saying, kind of done a full circle of the conversation, I'm still Hannah. And I think, yeah, I've kind of gone off a tangent in a classic ADHD fashion. But it's, yeah, I think it's understanding how it can implicate things, how it can impact medical conditions, how it can impact your mental health and all of that. But also knowing that just because that is something that can happen, it doesn't necessarily have to be your reality, and it might not be your reality because we are also different.
Yeah, yeah, I think so. I mean, I don't really say I am ADHD. I'd maybe sort of say I have ADHD because sometimes I don't feel like I have ADHD, and sometimes I feel like it's all I have. It's like my only personality. It's like it's just everything is ADHD that day. And today's probably one of those days where I just felt really overwhelmed. I'm all over the place, not quite sure where my brain is. I've left my phone in different places, not shut the car door properly. And I know why all of this is, because there's a lot going on in my life at the moment. But when I notice that I'm sort of feeling a bit more settled is when life is feeling a bit calmer. And so I have to always lean into that. And that's, you know, what I do with regards to the well-being side of everything. And the reason why I wrote this book is because I wanted to find like daily tools. I wanted to find practices and a way of living sustainably with ADHD. So it's not just the option. And many people just get this option of take some medication and that will help you concentrate. Take some medication that might kind of like help you feel less anxious, which is great. It's really great to have all of that, or a quieter mind, more energy. There's so many different reasons why I think medication is fantastic if it works. And for a lot of people, it doesn't work, or it's not something they want to take long term. So I have had to find ways that help me every single day, because my ADHD is always there every single day. I don't want it to take over my life. And for a while, it was definitely all I could feel. But I know also, as a woman who is 5, perimenopausal, my hormones are sort of all over the place. I notice it a lot more when those hormones are fluctuating. So there's new tools that I'm putting into place now as I get older, and I see how it kind of mutates in different ways. And it's important to have those tools in our back pocket. It's really, really important. And so we have to acknowledge that every single day, the choices that we make from the minute we wake up until we go to sleep do impact our ADHD. Mm-hmm. And yes, it can be a little bit exhausting to constantly be considering it, but it is worthwhile. And then we kind of get to a point where it's kind of second nature. We don't have to overthink it. We just kind of know I need to move my body today, or I need to make sure I'm hydrating enough, or have I been on my phone for too long, or actually I really need to go to bed early tonight because I can't do another day where I'm just so kind of exhausted. And I notice it come out in lots of different ways. I think I'm sort of finely tuned myself from all the work that I do and all the experts I've spoken to, and probably from writing the book as well. It's kind of really laser focused the importance of my sort of practices, my lifestyle practices. And yeah, I don't think there's anything wrong with acknowledging your ADHD every single day for that reason.
Absolutely. I think that is one of the biggest pieces for me about getting a diagnosis, was then understanding how ADHD shows up for me. And as you were saying, you know, it almost becomes second nature for you to check in with yourself. It's like, oh wait, how much water have I had? Have I had 5 cups of coffee today? Yeah, that's probably a reason why I'm not feeling great, or I didn't sleep very well last night. And I think that's, you know, that education and that learning piece is so important, to then know that you've got so many different tools in your back pocket for when things are feeling a bit difficult. And so then, you know, if you try one tool and you're like, it's not quite sitting with me today, you've got access to others, which leads us very nicely on to talking about your book. So would you like to tell us what the book is about and who the book's for?
Yeah, so it's a toolkit. It's the ADHD Women's Wellbeing Toolkit. And it is for, and I really did write this for every type of person that's in my community or type of person I've coached over the years. So it's for anyone. You don't have to have had a diagnosis. You could be waiting. You might just be curious. You might be reading it for someone who you love and you want to help support. It can meet you where you are, or you could have had that diagnosis and you know, you could have been offered medication, try the medication, it might not be, you know, for you. So this is just different ways where we can either calm our nervous system, you know, soothe anxiety, step into more kind of calm, find ways to emotionally regulate, ground ourselves. So it ranges from that kind of thing, more the like the emotional side, but things like finding fulfillment with this understanding, this new lens that we've got now, this new way of seeing ourselves, stepping into more joy, more creativity, which the creativity side lines up with the sort of lessening of the anxiety. We're recognizing that we're bringing in different tools to help ourselves. So it's really about this sort of full picture of well-being, like a holistic picture that we can paint, and we can pull different things from different times. We talk about hormones a lot as well, like really understanding our cycles and having more awareness around that, and having more awareness around how our ADHD might show up in different ways. And we also talk about RSD a lot in the book, which is, again, it can show up in so many different capacities. So try to bring so many different topics of stuff that I deal with from a personal perspective, but that I know I talk about in my workshops, in my community, in my coaching, and it's the same common denominators that have come up over time. So I just thought, I need this in a book. I need this for somebody who is either commuting or bedside table or in their bag on holiday, like whatever that is, and they can feel empowered with tools that they can lean on that minute, that day. It's not about having to get a diagnosis and then have some therapy. This is like, meet yourself where you are right now and find a chapter that works for you that day. And another thing that I did with that book is to make sure that you could open the book wherever. You don't have to, it's not like you have to read it from, you know, start to end. This is just, oh, I'm going to reread that anxiety chapter again because there's some breath work exercises. Mm-hmm. Or I'm going to learn about tapping, EFT, because that really helps kind of calm and regulate my nervous system. I'm really going to go into those chapters that I feel, or actually I've not had any creativity in my life for ages. And how do I even start? And you know, I've always been sort of conscious that we have to put the practical tools in there. How do I even become creative? So I've put little nudges and little prompts and things like that to help people. And it's all through this neuroaffirming lens. It's all through, we know there's ADHD in the mix. Okay, so let's make sure that's the main thing. And this is not a neurotypical book. This is for our brains and our nervous systems.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that's why I love it so much, is because it is the kind of, it's almost like having a friend with you who's always got recommendations for what you could do right now. And it's very much a could. I was saying to someone the other day that whenever someone says to me, you should do something, my guard goes straight up and I'm like, well, I feel inferior already. So it's very much, here's some suggestions of what you can try. And because there's multiple different things, it very much feels like you can drop in and out of it. But also there's that education element in it as well, of explaining different things like the hormones, like brain health, like nutrition, but it's easily accessible. It's not the kind of, you know, you've got to go and read 50,000 white papers to understand what's going on, because you've broken it down in such a nice way. So for me, it's such a nice thing to have. And also I find it very useful in terms of, so often I'll be finding something difficult and not have the words for it, but it's a great tool as well to explain it to other people. Like, can you just read this page? I mean, that's what I do with your podcast. Literally pretty much every single episode I either send to my mum or to my partner to say, just have a listen to this one, because it really explains what I'm feeling. And sometimes I think, like, that's something I find difficult, is vocalizing or explaining what I'm feeling. But the book and the podcast go hand in hand so nicely, but they're such a great way of understanding how you're feeling yourself by someone else putting the words together for you, but also sharing that with other people. So I am very grateful that you put the book together. And when is that out, and where can people go to get their hands on it?
Yeah, so it's out on the 17th of July. You can go to my website, but it's on every bookstore. Hopefully people will go into their local shops as well. That's what I would love, for people to go in and actually feel it and touch it and look at it. And I'm a huge fan of bookshops. And that's what I, you know, for me, the biggest thing is like, oh my God, someone's going to be able to see my book in a bookshop and flick through it, because it's very visual as well. And there's lots of, you know, little drawings and, you know, charts and things like that in different colors. And I've tried to make it very neurodivergent friendly. So yeah, wherever you get buy books from, it's there from the 17th of July. But there's also all information on my website, which is adhdwomenswellbeing.co.uk. Yeah, I have lots of workshops. There's a membership coming in the autumn. So yeah, lots going on. I'm looking forward to a little bit of a breather over the summer and then back to it after the summer.
Amazing. Well, yeah, I think that's what is so fantastic about the community that you've created is there are so many resources. And like you say, whether somebody is newly diagnosed, whether they're curious about whether they've got ADHD, or you know, if they're looking to find out more information about the different topics we've spoken about, like hormones and RSD, you've got so much content on your website to help people with all those different aspects. So I think what you've created is, it's fantastic. So thank you so much for coming on and talking to us today. It was such an insightful conversation, so I really appreciate having you.
Thank you, Hannah. It's been great. Love this conversation.
If you enjoyed listening today, you won't want to miss next week's episode, so be sure to subscribe. Eating disorders are crippling illnesses, but with the right support, they can be recovered from. We really hope you enjoyed this episode, but if you require more support right now, please look into charities such as First Steps and Beat for support, or talk to someone you trust.